Morning again. The court calls United States v. Jasper. Counsel for the appellant.
Chief Judge Baker, may it please the court. My name is Major Jacob Bayshore, and I, along with Colonel Jonathan Potter, represent the appellant, Sergeant Paul Jasper. In 2007, BK admitted to her pastor that she fabricated three allegations of sexual assault in order to get attention. The military judge in the Army Court took an unprecedented step by allowing BK to revoke her voluntary waiver of a regulatory privilege simply because BK was not advised fully of the legal aspects of privilege and waiver. This finding then trumped the fundamental constitutional rights of Sergeant Jasper to cross-examine the accuser and present a defense. As BK's credibility was the key issue at trial, and this admission to fabrication destroys her credibility as to all her allegations, this error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and all findings of guilty should be set aside and dismissed. First, the standard of review. As this court stated in Collier, Tanner, and Manns, when the military judge fails to conduct a balancing test on the record, the military judge receives less deference in the abuse of discretion analysis. When the military judge fails to conduct any balancing test, the military judge receives no deference, and this court should review the issue de novo. Military Rule of Evidence 510 Alpha requires the military judge to conduct a balancing between the presumption of waiver, the constitutional rights that are implicated in this case, and those facts that might make it inappropriate to apply the waiver. Here, the military judge failed to conduct that balancing test. He made no findings of fact. He cited no case law or rules of evidence throughout the entire motions hearing to include during his actual findings, and he made no conclusions of law other than that the finding that there had been no waiver of the privilege. As a result, this court should review the issues raised in assignments of error 1 and 2 de novo. The clergy penitent privilege is a societal deemed privilege from statutory construction, and the purpose is to allow the person to disclose their sins in confidence in order to seek the guidance and the forgiveness that that person needs. This court said in Shelton that this privilege should be strictly construed, and the reason is because that every man, the public, has a right to the truth, and privileges, they often make that truth not come out the way that it should. As the Supreme Court said in Trammell, excluding this relevant evidence has to have a public good in order to rationalize the means of not allowing the entirety of the truth to come out.
Can you tick-tock a couple of facts for us? In your view, was the appellant aware of the information before the trial counsel disclosed it to defense counsel?
The only evidence of that, Your Honor, would be from the Article 32 testimony, which is cited by the defense counsel at the beginning of the motions hearing, which is not in your joint appendix, but basically the mother, AJ, at the end of her Article 32 testimony, indicates that the reason they moved from Ohio back to Alabama was because the pastor didn't believe the allegations. Off of that alone, I believe that there would have been waiver. The court doesn't need to look at the 32 because there was actually express authorization by AJ and her daughter.
And in the appellant's view, when the pastor contacted AJ and BK, did he ask for their consent to disclose?
Yes, Your Honor. He specifically asked for their consent. He didn't explain military rules of evidence or that there was a privilege per se, but he said, hey, I'd like to disclose this to other people. Can I do it, yes or no? Now, the military judge, since he made no findings of fact, he claims he didn't tell them who he was going to release this information to. AJ says, well, he told me he was going to release it to the prosecutors. The Army Court makes their own finding of fact.
Can one infer from that an understanding that consent would need to be given and therefore there was some sort of protection to that information?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That was the argument that the defense counsel made at trial, was the simple posing of the question, yes or no, may I talk to others? AJ could have said no. BK could have said no. They could have asked more questions. Well, why are you asking me if you can talk to others? But they didn't. They simply gave their consent. AJ said that gave permission to tell what he knew at Joint Appendix 34. That's a very broad of permission that was granted. BK also, the only evidence on the record is she gave permission. What BK states is, well, I thought he was just going to talk to the prosecutor. But that prosecutor is outside of the privilege communication. There's no prosecutor-accuser privilege. So once a third party is informed of this significant matter, the entire privilege goes away. If they had learned of this information, of this privilege prior to the disclosure, they could have cut it off. But once the disclosure occurs, there's no legitimate function left for the privilege to maintain. There's no privacy interest. If you look directly at the language of 503 alpha, it says, 503 G3, a communication is confidential if it is not intended to be disclosed to third persons other than those to whom disclosure is in furtherance of the purpose of the communication. Defense counsel conceded at trial that this was a privileged communication, at least as it pertains to 2007. But by 2010, BK and AJ both consented to the release to a third party. At that point, there's no longer a privilege. There no longer seems to be that need for confidentiality that society recognizes in 503. Looking at 510, that's where our waiver comes in. And the government cites no court, no case that finds a waiver such as this would be inappropriate to apply.
Counsel, what does that language in 510 alpha mean, where they say it would be inappropriate to allow the claim of the privilege? Under what circumstances would it be inappropriate?
Right, Your Honor. There's been no military case law in that language particularly. But the analysis to 510, it incorporates a lot of 511, looking at coercion and not having the opportunity to invoke the privilege. I eavesdropper, or maybe the military judge erroneously forces them to testify. The only example the analysis in 510 gives is when one law enforcement agent discloses to another law enforcement agent outside, I guess, their own agency, the identity of an informant under a 507 analysis. We can see that applying here as well. If the pastor had called another pastor he respects and says, hey, I have this this penitent, she's come and confessed to this, that, and the other. What do you advise that I counsel her on in helping seek her, forgiveness or whatnot?
Well, why wouldn't the lack of knowledge of the privilege at all be a circumstance where it would be inappropriate?
I think it'd be actually the opposite, Your Honor, because if you have a lack of knowledge that the privilege even exists, the privilege was not necessary to induce the communications in the first place. That's the whole purpose of 503, in order to induce these private communications so that if you do commit some sort of wrong, that you can go to your clergy person and you can talk to them in order to seek your spiritual guidance, to seek forgiveness from God. It's not so you can use it as a shield 3 years later to protect yourself from a withering cross-examination, as the government did here.
Is that language found anywhere else in other rules?
Inappropriate?
Yeah.
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. It doesn't appear to be defined anything further, and I think it would be limited pretty much to 511 type of information. If the eavesdropper, the operator, I think maybe it dates the MCM a little bit, but the operator transfers a line and stays on the line and hears the information that they weren't required to hear. The key aspect is the disclosure to the third person. If BK, AJ had been walking out of church on a Sunday morning after the pastor spoke, and they decided that they wanted to talk to the pastor in a side room, but BK and AJ had a friend with them, and they went into that side room and they disclosed some private communications, this court would find that there was no privilege at all because a third person was present. The same applies in this case. A third person just learned of it 3 years later after the pastor asked that permission in order to disclose, and then he did disclose to both trial counsel and the government.
Is waiver the wrong term?
Waiver is completely the wrong term, Your Honor, as all the scholars...
Because a waiver has to be knowing. And
right.
By definition, this isn't knowing.
This isn't knowing, Your Honor.
If you don't know the privilege exists, you obviously can't knowingly waive it.
That's right, Your Honor. The district court in Champion, citing McCormick, said, regardless of the knowledge of the privilege, once the information comes out on a voluntary act of the penitent, that case wasn't a penitent, but of the privilege holder, that it's out for all times. Knowing applies, and this is what the trial counsel argued at trial and what the governor argued at the Army Court, which they seems to abandon at this court, is that knowing is a Johnson v. Zerps type analysis, but that deals with an accused's constitutional rights not to incriminate himself. And if you look back to the history of why that knowing is required, which not even necessarily all scholars agree that it should be that level of knowing to waive your rights, it's because of police abuse. In the military, because of the authority of senior persons over subordinates, and that we don't want them to be able to use that seniority or that authoritative position in order to extrapolate confessions unlawfully. Here, there's none of those concerns whatsoever. This is not a constitutional right of the privilege holder. It is simply a regulatory privilege because society recognizes need. But as all of the scholars say, once that information comes out, it's gone for all time. I think one court states it's not like a bird which you can catch and put back in a cage. It's gone forever. And it's especially important in this case where Sergeant Jasper was denied his Sixth Amendment right to cross-examine DK and his right to present a defense in Pastor Allison in order to get out this extremely culpable or exculpatory information. I think it's important for this court to look at how the information came out in the first place. The trial counsel called the pastor. And she didn't need to do that. She could have went straight to the accuser and talked to her. They had that relationship, presumably. She calls the pastor seeking this information. Pastor says, I can't talk. I got to get consent. Trial counsel says, yes, you do. Pastor calls his own attorney. He then calls the mother. The mother says, you can tell what you know. I'll talk to BK, and she'll call you back. BK calls back, says, you have my permission. At that time, the pastor calls trial counsel, and then at some point later, I'm not sure who called him, but he tells the defense counsel. The assistant trial counsel then appears within a matter of days. He drives down to her location in order to inform her of the privilege. It seems like it's almost a conflict of interest for the way the assistant trial counsel approached this case. He informs her of the privilege, and then he brings her into court 2 weeks later, and as AJ the mother testified, he had just refreshed her memory on what she needed to say about asserting the privilege before she walked into the court that morning.
Assuming you're correct on the first issue, why should we set aside the conviction as to all of the counts? There are several of the counts that are corroborated by the mother, for instance, who viewed the pictures on the cell phone.
Yes, Your Honor. BK's credibility goes to absolutely every one of these specifications. Almost every element to every specification. Look how the government used this evidence. First, they prevented it from coming into court. Next, they have their seal, then they use it as a sword. During the closing arguments, the government counsel says, he repeatedly bolsters BK's credibility. He says that BK provided very convincing testimony at Joint Appendix 261. BK can't make that kind of detail up at Joint Appendix 266. And you can't make that up at Joint Appendix 270. But this, I think, Judge Ehrman, goes straight to your question why it applies to all of the allegations. Because we're not dealing with a case where we have video proof of the assaults. We have DNA evidence. This is merely testimonial from mother and daughter. The assistant trial counsel says, you're going to hear all the motives that BK might have to lie about what she's saying. Well, if that's true, there's one heck of a conspiracy going on. If she's lying about this stuff, I guess, and I'm paraphrasing here, everyone is somehow in on it. Well, I don't know who was in on it, but it appears that the government, at least at some level, was in on it. When they not only prevent the finders of fact from learning this information, they then bolster her credibility and argue that, look at this young high school girl. Why on earth would she come in here and lie? She's not a liar. Her mother testified how good of a girl she was, how she was a captain, a company commander of her junior ROTC, unit in high school, how she was a cheerleader captain. So this fine young lady wouldn't come in here and lie. And the government uses that to their advantage after they won the motion. And that was incorrect. And by doing so, it touches on her credibility as it touches every specification alleged. It also goes back to the mother did testify that she saw some pictures. But the picture she seems to talk about wouldn't have covered specification 4 because they weren't self-portraits. And it's important to note, she says she didn't find any text messages on his phone that allegedly occurred. The daughter didn't provide any of the text messages that were supposedly sent from her phone. There was no pictures found on her phone or his phone. And when you look at all that, under a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which the government concedes, yet the government does not rebut at all. The government had their chance to say, this is why it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and they didn't even take a swipe at it. And, Your Honor, the defense position is that infers that their case is weak and they can't meet that very high hurdle. That is purely their burden. Any of your questions?
Thank you, counsel. You'll have time on rebuttal. Counsel with the government, please.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, Senior Judge Efron, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Captain Campbell Warner, and along with Major Daniel Maurer, I represent the government. This court should affirm the findings and sentence for three reasons. First, the military judge properly ruled that the clergy penitent privilege was not waived, and the Army Corps correctly affirmed that ruling. Second, the military judge properly defined child as a person under 18 with respect to the child pornography specifications. And finally, the omission of the terminal elements did not materially prejudice the appellant.
Counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
Even if I agreed with you that the military judge was correct to say that there was no waiver in this case, how does the government deal with the use that the trial counsel made of by saying that she was credible and making this all about credibility when they knew that she had at some point recanted and said that she made everything up? How do you justify that?
Well, having a personal knowledge of what the assistant trial counsel was thinking, it would be purely speculation, Your Honor.
I'm not asking you to tell me what he was thinking. I'm asking you to justify it.
I do not think that was the best trial tactic in the world, I'll put it that way, Your Honor. I certainly, ATs were disingenuous, but I do think there is an issue when you do make the case in your closing argument all about her credibility, and there is a set of piece hanging out there. Certainly, I think the assistant trial counsel could have and should have done a better job of tailoring that closing so as not to present that issue as forcefully as he did in front of the panel. So I agree, that is problematic. It's certainly not the cleanest case in the world, certainly not the best example of pretrial preparation or of...
Does the record reveal at all how the defense found out? Was there a disclosure by the prosecution?
The record is not clear on this, Your Honor. There are unfortunately a lot of gaps in the record here. As under the government's reading of the record, what it looks like is the trial counsel called this pastor during pretrial preparation for whatever reason. Based on the government's reading, the pastor inadvertently disclosed this information, and the government, to its credit, immediately disclosed that to the defense under Brady. And then we've got the having to go back and discuss privilege with AJ and with BK and the pastor. So based on our reading, it's an inadvertent disclosure at first, and there was no chance for AJ or BK to claim the privilege. There are also some gaps in the record as far as after that initial disclosure, assuming that was the case, was there a subsequent ratification? Did Pastor Ellison tell AJ and BK, by the way, I already let the cat out of the bag as far as this goes with the government. Were you okay with that? Are you going to ratify that? And we simply don't know one way or the other. The timeline certainly is unclear.
What is the purpose of the privilege?
So the purpose of the privilege is to maintain in secret communications between parties that society deems sacred. So clergy, penitent, attorney, client, things of that nature. We want to be able to enforce honest communications between those parties without fear that it's going to be broadcast worldwide without consent.
Once the information is no longer secret, what's the purpose of trying to maintain the privilege?
Your Honor, I think that depends on the circumstances, and the military rules of evidence indicate that there are circumstances where that information can be broadcast to third parties without the privilege being vitiated, such as disclosure by a non-privilege holder and the privilege holder didn't have a chance to claim the privilege, or the telephone operator example or something like that. Now, Rule 510, this addresses your question earlier, Your Honor. That rule has language under such circumstances that it would be inappropriate to allow the claim of privilege. We don't have that in the federal rules. Obviously, it's common law. We don't have that under proposed federal Rule 510, which the Champion International case discusses. That discusses the Supreme Court standard 511 based on proposed federal Rule 510. And that rule says voluntary disclosure or voluntary consent waives a privilege, full stop, end of sentence. The military rule has this additional language in there, so obviously it's got to mean something. We don't have rules and statutes.
Does 510 say anything about a knowing and intelligent waiver?
It does not, Your Honor.
It does not. The cat's out of the bag.
Yes.
So what is the further interest? Isn't it waived? Doesn't the disclosure with the permission of the privilege holder in this?
If the rule said voluntary disclosure or consent to disclosure results in waiver.
No. Privilege is disfavored. It's to be narrowly construed.
Yes, sir.
It's the cat's out of the bag. Why doesn't that end this inquiry?
Because of the language of the rule, Your Honor. This goes to the language of Rule 510.
Okay, and you tell me why the language of the rule compels this result.
Because it says under such circumstances, Your Honor, that language...
That's awfully vague.
It is, I agree.
So you tell me why that vague language compels this result. Because the privilege is to be narrowly construed.
It is, and in light of the policy of privilege, it is to be narrowly construed. The government invites this court to tell us what under such circumstances mean, whether it's in the government's favor or against the government's favor,
What do you think the circumstances are in this case that would vitiate what appears to have been a waiver?
Can you repeat the first part of your question, Your Honor?
Sir, what are the circumstances of this case that make you believe that we should say that there was no waiver in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I think the fact that the victim was a minor, I think it's a factor to consider. I think the victim's lack of knowledge about the privilege. Now, this addresses Judge Stuckey's point. You're absolutely right, sir. Knowing is not in the language of the statute, and if the president intended it to be voluntary and knowing, he absolutely could have said so. But under such circumstances, it's awfully squishy language.
Didn't the pastor ask for their permission?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Did the pastor ask their permission to disclose?
The pastor asked AJ for her permission, whatever that means. The record, again, is not clear on exactly what they did or did not talk about. Pastor Ellison says, I don't think she understood that she had a privilege.
But she certainly understood that he was asking her permission.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which she could have refused.
Yes, sir. She could have. Now, he did not talk to BK at all. So we have this game of telephone, basically, where the pastor talks to the mother and then calls BK. BK leaves a message.
Is there anything in the record that casts doubt on the fact that BK consented? She left him a message saying...
I give you permission, again.
Yeah, I give you permission.
Permission is not, okay.
Say again, sir?
She said permission, did she not?
Yes, Your Honor, she did. She said, I gave permission. Now, the record doesn't indicate what that permission entailed, what the scope of it was.
Well, since it doesn't contain any limitations, aren't we to assume then that it's a permission? You can talk.
Again, that's a factor to consider, Your Honor. If we're going to talk about under these circumstances, based on that language, I think totality of the circumstances, unless this court wants to provide a more specific definition saying we will look at these specific things, certainly something for this court to consider. I can't stand up here and say, no, don't consider that.
Well, so let me ask you this question in a slightly different way. Let's assume that it wasn't privileged. Okay, let's assume that it wasn't privileged without asking you to concede that.
Yes, ma'am.
And let's assume that the government made a motion, a pretrial motion saying, we think it'll be too traumatic for this young girl to have the priest come in and testify that she made everything up. And so we're making a motion in limine for you to prohibit that testimony. Okay?
Yes, ma'am.
And it came up here. Do you think that we would think that that didn't infringe important constitutional rights?
I think that if the judge granted that motion, that would be reversible error.
Okay, and so if the effect of finding a privilege here in light of the government knowing what she had said would be the same result as the military judge having granted that motion in limine, don't you think that that's problematic?
Well, I disagree that those are the same circumstances, Your Honor. In your example, you're saying it's never privileged to begin with, and the government is trying to keep out evidence where there really is there's no legitimate basis for exclusion. In this case, the defense conceded that the communication was privileged at the outset. So assuming, for the sake of argument, that it was not waived, as the government asserts.
But the problem is you know about it, right? And we know about it. And the military judge knew about it. And so doesn't that sort of put you to a Hobson's choice in some sense that your choices, maybe at trial, should have been either the information comes in or you can dismiss the charges. Right, because there's constitutionally required information out there that we all know about.
But the constitutionally required information still has to be admissible, Your Honor.
But don't you think that that's one of the circumstances that should be considered in this case?
I don't think so in this case, Your Honor, because when we're talking about whether the privilege was waived, we don't look at what the information was. The question is, was a communication privileged or not? If it is privileged, is it subsequently waived? So you look at the circumstances surrounding a waiver. For example, what's the privilege holder's age? Did the privilege holder know about the privilege? Is there any confusion about the privilege at all?
What is the relevance of where the privilege owner knew the legal contours of the privilege? The rule says nothing about that.
It is not specifically in the rule, Your Honor, the government...
It doesn't, not specifically, it doesn't say anything, period. Stop. Now, what's the relevance of whether or not they knew the legal contours of the privilege?
I think it's a circumstance to consider under the... under the language, under such circumstances that it would be inappropriate to allow the claim of privilege. That's where the government argues that it comes in, Your Honor, is it is a factor to consider. It's not the hard and fast language such as voluntary disclosure or consent to disclosure.
Counsel, let's assume in this case that BK is the accused and BK's statement to clergy is a complete confession of all elements of the offense. Would the government's position then be that the statement's inadmissible under the if all the other circumstances of this case are the same?
I think the circumstances need to be weighed, Your Honor, absolutely. And if the circumstances are weighed and there is a finding that under these circumstances it is not appropriate to push away the privilege, or in other words, I phrase that poorly, it is appropriate to continue here to allow the claim of privilege. That could be a problem.
So under the government's theory, who is it that obtains this waiver? Is it the responsibility of the clergy person to explain the legal details of the privilege and obtain a Johnson against Zerbs knowing involuntary waiver? And what's the implication of the government's position?
Understanding your question, you're asking if the court rules in the government's favor today, what is the implication for this down the line?
Right, and when
tries to pierce privilege.
When we got husband-wife privilege, when we've got clergy privilege, we've got lawyer and client privilege, lots of those cases, we got cases in which people have made statements and the government has used them at trial. Now, does the government have to either itself or via the person receiving the privilege statement, the lawyer, the clergy person, the spouse who's receiving the statement, do they have to give a Johnson against Zerbs warning? I mean, in a spousal relationship, are people going to be giving warnings to each other? I mean, where are we going with this?
Let me answer it this way first, Your Honor. The bottom line is, if I'm understanding where you're going with this, if the court rules in the government's favor today on this case, does it make the government's job more difficult to get otherwise privileged statements in the future? Absolutely it does. We can't sit here and say, It works one way in this case, it works a different way in another case.
I'm not worried about whether it's more difficult or not, I'm worried about how it works. In other words, who is it, under the government's theory, that has to give the statement as to what the privilege obtains and obtain the voluntariness? Is it the person receiving the statement? Is it the spouse? Is it the lawyer? Is it the clergy person? Now is in the position of, let's say, a commander or a CID agent would be. First you got to give a Miranda or Article 31 type warning before you can get the statement, or even afterwards, do you have to confirm that before you can disclose it?
As far as who needs to get the, who needs to provide that information, Your Honor, I think the simple answer is the party seeking consent. In this case, Pastor Ellison said, well, I need to get consent, so Pastor Ellison needed to be the one to discuss specifically.
What if instead of what happened, she told her girlfriend the exact same thing? Okay? Would you agree there that there was no longer a privilege?
It depends on what the circumstances are, Your Honor. We've got
She's having a sleepover with her girlfriend, and she said, boy, you should see, the trouble I'm getting my dad in, and I feel pretty bad about it because I just made it all up because I wanted to get attention, and that's what I told the pastor.
Well, what you have there in that case, Your Honor, is you've got her making the decision herself to do this in the sleepover example. In this case here, we don't have any direct communication between Pastor Ellison and BK. We can infer from the record that AJ talked to BK at some point and said, call Pastor Ellison. We know that had to happen, but there's nothing anywhere in the record.
She gave her permission. How much clearer does it need to be?
We don't know what AJ conveyed to BK about that, though, Your Honor, and that's where the bit of a hang-up is here, is there's this missing link in the communications. We don't know if AJ said, you need to call him, and it's up to you if you want him to talk to anybody or not, or we don't know if AJ said, call him and tell him that it's okay. I'm telling you need to do this. So I think...
What difference does it make?
Well, I think it goes to possibly the voluntary nature of the consent to disclose, Your Honor. Was it truly her voluntary decision, or was this coerced by her mother?
Well, I mean, who's got the burden of showing that?
Well, that goes to the second part of the argument, Your Honor, who has the burden of showing waiver. And the government argues that the party seeking the privileged information has the burden of proving waiver. The party that asserts the privilege has the burden of proving the privilege. The case law is clear on that point. In this case, the defense conceded twice on the record, yeah, the initial communication was privileged. So now we're in waiver land under Rule 510. And that should be the burden of the party that is seeking to pierce the privilege. It also makes sense because if you're going to make the party asserting the privilege also disprove waiver, that party is basically in the position of having to prove a negative, and they would have to disprove every single possible way that the privilege could be waived. So it makes sense to shift the burden of proving waiver to the party seeking.
Well, and the cat's out of the bag. Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead.
Would you address briefly the 1618 quandary?
Yes, sir.
It seemed, you know, in the code, the only age mentioned is 16. For minors, you know, okay. There's nothing in the spec on 18.
Correct.
There's nothing in the code on 18.
Correct.
How's he on notice that he has to defend against 18?
Can I ask just as a predicate question? When the government amended the specification to pull out the CPPA language,
yes, sir.
Did that turn it into a military offense? Is 134, 1 and 2 a military offense?
It is, Your Honor. I mean, anything under the code is a military offense, but Article 134 applying specifically to service members, clauses 1 and 2. The crime, I mean, it's got those specific military elements. So it is a military offense in that case, not assimilating.
Back over here. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Now, Your Honor, with respect to child under 16, the only place where a child is specifically defined in a statute as being a person under 16 is old Article 120, now Article 120B, and it says in this section, child means a person under 16. If you look at other sections, such as Section 125, Article 134, Article 128, the elements and explanation sections discuss children, but it uses the language child under 16. And just a plain meaning indicates if you're talking about a child under 16, you would have to have a child over the age of 16. Furthermore, just because it's charged as child pornography under Clause 1 and 2 with no reference to Clause 3 doesn't preclude a military judge from referring to the CPPA and defining those relevant.
Why?
That's a situation that this court dealt with in Barbary, U.S. versus Barbary. There we had possession of child pornography, charged under clauses 1 and 2, no reference to clause 3. The military judge referred to the CPPA, pulled out the relevant definitions, and this court had no issue with that. And Judge Stuckey, I believe your concurrence there, dealt with child pornography and stated that child pornography should be considered a term of art. So if you use the word child pornography, you're pulling in those definitions, whether you're assimilating or whether you're charging it under clause 1 and 2.
That's why the government is not bothered by the seeming inconsistency of treating a child for the purpose of child pornography as under 18, but not for the purposes of, for example, being in the armed forces and so on.
Correct.
Because it's a term of art, and in this particular term, we use it as under 18.
Well, I think it can be a term of art. Now, I'll note that that was Judge Stuckey's concurrence in Barbary, so that is not a holding of this court, but I certainly think that that is something to look at. Child pornography, much like obscenity, that has a specific meaning. Now, if you just look at the plain language of Article 120, it says, in this section, child means...
Okay, and where, you know, admittedly, that applies to 120.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, where in the code does it use 18?
Well, if you look at Article 43, Your Honor, it deals with statute of limitations, so admittedly, it's not an on-point...
Oh, and where in the code, in the definition of any offense, does it use 18?
It does not. Article
it does not.
Only section
okay.
Where child is specifically
okay,
defined.
And here you got a 17-year-old.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, who's right in the right smack in the middle.
Yes.
And what in the spec told him that he had to defend against a 17-year-old?
Well, there's nothing... Absent the statutory language was stricken when the specifications were amended,
right.
There's nothing in there that says child under 18. Now, it is worth noting that when the jury instructions, were being discussed, the defense did not object to any of the definitions under the CPPA. It doesn't object to the overall definition of child pornography, sexually explicit conduct, all those other terms that are present from the CPPA. The only one the defense objects to is definition of child. Common sense indicates that if you had a problem with the military judge referring to the CPPA, you wouldn't object just to this one definition. You would object to the entire thing. So I think this indicates that the defense's objection is a little disingenuous.
If the military judge would have held that the age was 16 from the UCMJ, would that have been error? Or would that have just been a discretionary determination of the military judge based on two different legal theories, both of which have some legs?
I think under Barbary, it would not. I don't think it would be error. I think the military judge has some discretion there. There's specific language in the majority opinion in Barbary that says, with a Clause 1 and 2 offense, no reference to Clause 3 at all, no reference to other federal language, when it just says child pornography, Clause 1 and 2, the military judge may, but is not required, to use the language from the CPPA, and this court indicated that if the military judge wanted to use different definitions, that certainly would be a possibility. That was not something that this court foreclosed.
If you were to lose on, in the hypothetical, on the privilege issue, why would that impact or not impact the finding on the child porn charge, putting aside the outcome on 16, 18, and things in between?
Yes, Your Honor. So, if I understand, basically a harmless analysis. With respect to, if this court finds that the military judge erred, the pre-recantation offenses and indecent acts, those have to be set aside for a rehearing. The government's not even going to attempt to try to argue that that was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. With respect to the child pornography offenses, though, there is other evidence in addition to BK's testimony. You have the mother who testified, yes, I saw the photographs, and some of them had her hands, indicating that somebody else had to take those photographs. You've got the circumstances under which she found the photographs, hidden in, I believe, her husband's pajama pants pocket instead of right by his side or on the nightstand where he normally keeps it. When she confronts him about it, he chases her outside into the front yard, gets her in a bear hug, snatches the phone away from her, indicating there's something on that phone you're not supposed to have. Furthermore, the victim's sister, TJ, testified that the appellant ran outside wearing nothing but a towel, which is pretty damning evidence in and of itself. So with respect to those offenses and with the obstructing justice, to which BK was not even a witness, AJ was the sole witness to the obstructing justice, those specifications, government argue, would survive under harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis.
Before we close, I'm a little bothered by the fact that you described defense counsel's argument as disingenuous. Do you have anything to back that up?
The argument with respect to the
age.
And when I said disingenuous, I'm referring to their objection at the trial court level, Your Honor.
Right.
So I just think that if you are looking at, if you're objecting to using the CPPA, it doesn't make sense to object only to one part of it and not import the rest of it.
You lose me there. But you don't need to go on.
Yes, Your Honor. Any further questions?
Okay, thank you very much. Counsel for the appellant, rebuttal.
Chief Judge Baker, you asked about the harmless analysis as it relates to 84 as to 81 and 2. Sergeant Jasper's position that this court should find 81 to be dispositive on all specifications and you don't need to get to 84. But to Judge Stuckey, to your questions, as it deals with assignment of error form, the age was dispositive. And counsel didn't need to argue about the definition of pornography because arguably, for his argument to stay consistent, a plain language type definition of pornography would likely be more broad than the CPPA. So the CPPA there got the appellant more narrow definition, but not as to age. Because everywhere in the UCMJ, to include 611D, where the president defines child as it deals with abuse of a child and child pornography, he's talking about age 16 is what the president states. The problem with this, giving the judge complete control to make his own elements, his own instructions after the merits, is what the military judge did here with the affirmative defense in the CPPA. He declined to even consider the affirmative defense because it was not charged under the statute, the Joint Appendix 235. So the judge is kind of on a whim choosing what he wants to apply and what he doesn't. And
counsel, is it your position that the child pornography offenses were charged as Clause 3, Article 134 offenses, or something else?
They were originally charged as 1, 2, and 3, Your Honor, and then they struck the Clause 3 language, leaving a purely military offense. And at that time, prior to arraignment, he's left with the plain language of child and pornography. At common law, 14 was the age of trial. In the UCMJ, it's 16 in its entirety. What the government should have done, as they proffer do with most child pornography clause 1 and 2 offenses, is say child pornography as defined by 18 U.S.C. 2256. That way, they don't have to worry about giving notice to the individual. Clearly is on notice from the very beginning of where the government is looking, what they're looking to criminalize and how they're defining this term that's not explicitly defined. Judge Ryan, to your question regarding...
So that suggests that, in your view, it's not there's not a correct age limit, but a fair notice age limit.
Well, Your Honor,
right?
I think...
Because you're saying, as a military offense, he could be charged with having 17-year-old child pornography. It's just that he didn't know in this case that that's how they were going to proceed.
I think it is both. I believe they could have said as defined by 18 U.S.C. 2256 and incorporated that definition into Clause 1 and 2 offenses. Here they just didn't do it. So it's both.
So that's a fair notice issue rather than a threshold sufficiency issue.
I still think it's both, Your Honor, but yes, it's a notice issue, and then it's where is the accused supposed to look for the definition? He goes to the UCMJ, and that's where he finds 16.
Do you think that if it's charged as a clause, if it's charged under Clause 3 as a violation of a federal statute, do you think that we have authority to change the age limit?
Not under Clause 3, Your Honor. No, you wouldn't. Your Honor, as to your questions regarding assignments of error 1, if this court does not find waiver, well, Sergeant Jasper doesn't see a scenario where you could do that without overruling significant case law from his own court, such as McElhaney. Even if there is no waiver under 503, the Sixth Amendment trumps, as the United States Supreme Court talks about in Davis v. Alaska and Nixon. And when you look at Davis v. Alaska and Nixon, and you put them together, it really calls into question the whole idea of privileges in the first place, especially when there is the release of information that requires that Sergeant Jasper have the ability to both present his exculpatory evidence and to then impeach the primary accuser that the government presents.
With respect to the age, did the defense at any point make a motion to dismiss on the grounds that the age was not proven in this case?
No, Your Honor. They simply asked that the instructions be tailored to not allow them to find age. They didn't make their own specific.
Not allow them to find age. Well, what difference would that make in terms of the offense?
They didn't do a 917 motion, Your Honor. That's all I'm sorry.
Right. But what would be the result if the judge had granted the defense motion? Where would you be?
I think in that scenario, the specifications would be forever lost to the government. They wouldn't be able to recharge or re-prosecute.
But would the judge have to dismiss at that point? In other words, I'm trying to figure out what was going on at trial.
If the judge had determined that the proper age was 16, Your Honor, there was no way for the government to get over that hurdle because she was clearly 17. So
why didn't the defense move to dismiss at that point based upon the evidence? I'm trying to figure out what legal theory the defense was offering to the judge to consider.
Your Honor, that's not in the record. I don't know why they didn't make a 917 motion. It's just clear that they objected to the definition being 18. They believed the definition should be 16, and that precluded the panel from finding him guilty.
And did the defense at any point say that they lacked the notice to defend the case?
They didn't say it explicitly, but the trial counsel makes it clear in his argument when the judge asked, do you have any questions or do you have any problems with this defense counsel? Counsel stands up, says, yes, Your Honor. He immediately turns to the government counsel, and the government counsel at Joint Appendix 229 says there's no way that they were misled. So I think it's clear that the trial counsel understood that was part of the argument that the defense counsel was making, but he never explicitly says that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you very much. We thank both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we stand in recess until further order of the court.
All right. Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.